Hello, Space Junkies, and welcome to episode number 137 of What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Scott Bauman, and joining me is my original co-host and co-pilot of the podcast here in the Drunken Gungan cockpit, Mr. Derek Marsh. Derek, how's it going?
Happy Mario Day.
Yes, happy Mario Day. We are recording this episode on March the 10th in the year of our Lord 2024. So if you put March and 10 together, it's M-A-R-1-0, but more like Mario.
Yes, in leet speak, right? Is how those, the kids used to say that back in the early 2000s.
Yes.
So
yes, leet speak from a mere 20-something years ago.
Yeah, nowadays they don't even make anything. Everything is just an acronym. And I'm like, I have no idea what this 10-digit acronym even stands for, kids. We're all IYKYK.
Yes. We're all like some sort of droid designation there, like AZ-1 or AZ-I, which it was cool to see him back in The Bad Batch. And you know who else has been happy to see Clone Wars characters return? That's right, our original Dave Filoni, my Wookiee co-pilot, the gooey, chewy, Mr. Miracle, man of a thousand nicknames, Nathan Miracle. Nathan, how's it going?
I want my hour of sleep back.
Yes. You're going to have to wait 6 months.
I know.
It is funny that on Mario Day is when we jumped forward.
Okay.
I mean, I appreciate the dad joke, so it was funny.
But you know what I am happy about is yesterday, I've told these guys this, but for our listeners, I got to go to a Comic Con, not Comic Con, because legally distinct, here in Matthews.
We represent the legally distinct.
Exactly. Yes. And I, of course, wore my cosplay, which involved putting on my cowboy hat.
And that's it.
And that's it. That is. That's it. I also wore the Wolfpack t-shirt. Oh, okay. And the Rex jacket, because it was kind of cool yesterday. Dropped in on the 501st, and they immediately went, Dave! Yes! Still got it.
Yes, good times.
And while I was there, this is unrelated to Star Wars, but I do love showing it off. Mr. Miracle, number 19. The return of Mr. Miracle.
Very cool.
Last seen in Mr. Miracle 18, but I believe there was a gap in the release schedule there.
So the question is, are you going to sign it?
Probably not this one. I mean, granted, you know, this was in the $5 bin, not the $75 first issue that I saw there, which I did not buy because $75.
I'm amazed that first issue of Mr. Miracle was $75.
It was at a con where they, you know, gouge us.
The third issue was $50. No, excuse me. The third issue was $32, and then the first appearance of Big Barda was $50.
Now that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, there's some great panels in that, but I'm not paying $50 for one comic that that quite frankly I plan to just put in a frame and hang up on the wall.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, you guys aren't here to listen to us talk about Mr. Miracle. You're here to listen to us talk to Mr. Miracle about Star Wars, and in this case, Star Wars The Bad Batch Season 3, Stuffy Doll. I mean, Episode 4.
Stuffy
a
Doll.
A different approach. That's right, yes. A different approach. So,
two Stuffy
let's
Dolls.
Let's kick it off with the five questions. Derek, what did you like best about Episode 4?
I thought this was a good episode. Obviously, you know, we've had the week off from recording. So, you know, we're going to cover both episode 4 and 5 today for the listeners. So this one is after the end where Crosshairs and Omega make the break, right? And they have to go do their little, you know, basically getting off the planet, and they've got a, you know, damaged ship, so they crash land and they got to deal with, you know, getting off this planet. And I thought the episode was good. My favorite thing about this episode, I mean, it wasn't bad. It wasn't fantastic, but like I said, it was just a good solid. I appreciate them getting a little bit more into the Crosshairs, more story with where he's going and what he's having to deal with. You obviously start to see more and more of like his hand shaking. You're continuing to see him not be the ace sniper shot that he always has been, right? But he still got it, right? There's some fun things where he still ends up hitting the targets. Overall, I just kind of like that, where you continue to see that, and then the relationship with him and Omega, you're seeing Omega's character continue to grow a little bit, where I'll leave that for question two of what I disliked about it. But like I said, I really did enjoy the Crosshairs character growth.
Yeah, I agree that Crosshairs had a lot going on in this episode. For me, my favorite part of this episode was the fact that it was a quintessential Star Wars story. We basically had the dark side totally dominating at the beginning there, where Omega and Crosshair are having to run from things. They find their way to that spaceport that's there on the planet Lao, and they think they can get off by just buying a ticket onto a shuttle, but of course they need chain codes, and if they were to scan their chain codes, they'd be shown as fugitives from the Empire. And just when they think they have successfully outwitted the Empire and won a bunch of money in a card game, Captain Man shows up and is very much the corrupt, quintessential, almost cliched, corrupt Imperial official. But at the end of the episode, my favorite part was Omega is able to use the animals, the forces of nature, to help turn the tide against the Empire. And she and Crosshair are able to, defeat them and escape and steal the cargo ship. It felt a little bit like the end of Return of the Jedi, where the Empire thinks they've got it all wrapped up on Endor because they've captured the rebels, and then they didn't plan on the natives going crazy and attacking them. And so light side triumphs as the life force of nature overcomes the dark side force of technology. So it was a little less dark side at that moment. I got to get better at these transitions. And a little more light side. Nathan, what did you like best about this episode?
I think my favorite part of this episode was getting to see the Empire at work, because this is some of the earliest days of the Empire. And we really got to see an Imperial official be just incredibly corrupt, incredibly inept, quite frankly, because he played this whole not poker, not sabacc, but this whole different card game with a wanted fugitive and didn't even realize it. Like, yeah, he messed up Omega and Crosshair, but he messed them up just because he wanted to, not because he even realized that this is somebody that the Empire really wants to recover and send back to Mount Tantus. He has no clue what Mount Tantus is. He just knows these people need money. They're gambling to get money. I don't really care about that, but maybe I can swindle them. If I can't, I'm just going to charge them a fee and then steal their dog.
And then steal and your little dog too.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, he did not care. He only cared, what can I get out of this situation? Which to me is, the epitome of what's wrong with the Empire. The Empire is supposed to be there to help the citizens, or at least government is supposed to be there to help the citizens. Palpatine doesn't care, because Palpatine doesn't care, that all flows down, and the lower level management doesn't care about their own planets. Corruption is rife, and they'll install whoever will keep the peasants in line, basically. Yeah. So it was neat to see that at such an early stage, because quite often we don't see that until much later, like Andor period, when the Empire really starts putting their heel down on the populace.
Well, it goes to show you, though, to your point, right? But that's where you could definitely tell, like, this was probably a already corrupt planet.
Probably so.
right? The corrupt governor was already there, right? And that's who gets put in power, is these corrupt governors, politicians, as you mentioned, right? That are then quote unquote promoted to, you know, whatever military term that they're going to be, captain, whatever, right?
And like you said, off, whatever.
Yeah, whatever they're.
The regional governors will now have direct control over there. He reminded me a bit of Ariana Price. I just got done listening to the Thrawn book on audiobook, and it's a similar deal of, you know, I'm in charge, but it's really more about what is in it for me, not how can I serve the people.
Right, right. Okay, let's move on to question two. What did you dislike most about this episode? And I'm going to go first. I disliked the little kid that was the fruit vendor that was hanging out in front of the cantina where they go and play. Balans is the name of the card game, or Balans, where they go and play Balans. I just felt like he didn't really serve a point other than just to put another kid in the episode. Because, yes, he told them that the Empire had captured Batcher. So, you know, they took your dog. And he was a foil for some more of their money to be taken away, sure. But they could have easily done this part of the story without him. He just annoyed the heck out of me. I'm like, I get it. You're a street rat. You're trying to, you know, earn some coin. Everybody on this planet is a money-grubbing so-and-so or whatever. But, it was just over the top, a little too cliche. And I can't shake the feeling, though, that somehow the kid's going to show back up, because he and Omega will be friends, and he'll get a moment to help them against the Empire later in this season, because we know that Dave likes to do those interconnected stories with minor characters. In this case, it's a minor character. but anyway.
He could just be a short man.
He could be. But I don't think so. Anyway, that was my only gripe about this episode, though. Overall, I really enjoyed this episode. Like I said in question one, I felt it was quintessential Star Wars of the Empire's overconfident, relies on technology, tries to subjugate the planet, including all the wildlife, and their uppance has come. Derek, what did you dislike? You hinted around at it in question one there.
So, again, I like where they go with these characters when they're giving us good story, right? Where it's good character development. But I feel like, and this is a fault of Dave's or the people he has in the room help writing the stuff. They're really good at the Star Wars lore, but I feel like they sometimes really lack in character, remembering the character development that they've had over the past few seasons. And again, this could just be my interpretation, my perception, but I feel like I liked the way I feel like Omega's growing and where she's going, but I felt like it was really like not needed for her to be acting the way she was in regards to like, oh, we need to play it this way. Right. Like it was almost like, you know, like she was trying not to be violent, but yet she's literally for years at this point has been around the war and has been around this. And she should have been able to pick up the situation where it's like, just let Crosshairs do his thing. Like it's the Empire. Like, why do you even care that Crosshairs would kill them? Like they've treated you like slaves. They're killing your people. Like that's the whole reason you escaped Mount Tantus. Like you should have no remorse for this sloth of a captain, you know, whatever, you know, he's doing. Like, you know, it took her to like the final last thing for quote unquote before she said, okay, we'll do it your way, Crosshair. And it's like she should have been used to that already at this point. Like she's done enough missions, she's done enough things to see she's obviously very intelligent. And I just felt like it felt like a little bit of a we're just going to put it in to make it sound like a to write it to our portion of this story. And I just felt like we should have been beyond this, right? To your whole point that you just mentioned, Scott, like we didn't need that character in there to rob them 5,000. Like she should just let Crosshairs like literally threaten the kid. Like who cares? Like, you don't have to kill the kid, but you could have just threatened the kid literally. And he would just would have given spilled his beans because he didn't want to die. Right. But he didn't have to know that. Like, I don't know. I guess they're trying to, you know, play the soft heart where, you know, Omega is still trying to, you know, be this light side character and all this stuff. But it's like, this is the Empire. You got to beat them at their own game. And it's like finally at that point that she realized, but it's like we've been through this before. I felt like in the first two seasons that they've gone on these missions. So I don't know. But like I said, that was the part that I just didn't like on this episode. It's like, okay, finally, we finally get it where she says, let's do it your way. And then, of course, everything goes right and then they escape.
That's interesting.
I feel like it's Omega's innate nobility is just taking over. And even though she was just basically tortured at Mount Tantus, where they were like literally drawing her blood from her, along with torturing essentially the other clones there as well, and non-clones, whatever other life forms they're experimenting upon. But like, she doesn't want to become what she just saw at Mount Tantus. But also, she's still pragmatic enough to know, like you said at the end there, Derek, okay, we're just going to have to shoot our way out of it this time. We tried nonviolent means or intelligent and cunning means, and it just didn't work.
All right, I'm going to have to send this back through the Filoni hive mind, because apparently it didn't quite get through, because the way I interpreted it was that Omega wanted to get away without alerting the Empire to the fact that they were there in the first place. And she knows that if they blast their way out, the Empire is just going to follow them to the next stop. And she wanted to be able to sneak out. And once she realized that there was no chance of sneaking out, that's when she was like, okay, we can shoot them up. At that point, it's fine. There's nothing we can do at this point. He's already mentioned that he's going to contact Mount Tantus and bring in.
But to me, the Empire would already know that they're there because they could track the ship. Like they wouldn't have to know anything else.
They would know that they got to that planet. She's trying to get off that planet without leaving a trail of where they went from there.
Correct, but
the only reason the Empire finds them though is the Lao stormtroopers flying over see the thing. Like, it's not like Command calls them and says, hey, we found this shuttle that got stolen from Mount Tantus and crashed on your planet. They find the shuttle, call it in, and then Command is like, oh, I'll bet that's the shuttle that was stolen from Mount Tantus. We're sending you back up. Capture them.
I mean, I guess. But to me, it's like, why you wouldn't have your own ships have the ability to track them. But that's okay. So,
but that's the whole point. They do. That's why they ditched that ship and they're trying to get on a different ship.
I get that part. I'm not arguing with you on that. But to me, you would have been better off just doing what you're doing to get off the planet regardless, because even if they would have secretly, it's not like Hemlock wouldn't have gone in and just killed everybody for the information he needed. He would have tortured that person that Omega was trying to make a deal with until he got the information. Like, he would have known. Yeah. Through the things, because again, the corruption of the Empire, they know those people, right? They know where to go and find it. To me, it's, and again, maybe that's because I'm the observer and I know everything that, you know, is happening, blah blah blah, but I would assume that she should, you know that, okay, we just, like to your point, just get off this planet and then literally just hop from ship to ship at some point, right? But no matter what they do, they're basically going to get quote unquote tracked anyways. So anyways, that's just mine.
But why make it easy for them, you know?
Well, and then Crosshair ends up warning Omega about, we got to get rid of this cargo ship we just stole because the Empire is going to track this ship. And that's why she takes them to the remote location to meet up with Hunter and Wrecker. Instead of going right to
Pabu.
Anyway, Nathan, what did you dislike about this episode?
All right, the thing I dislike most about this episode is a very common trope that I pretty much never like, and that is the classic, okay, we only have this much money, and the way we're going to get a whole bunch more is by gambling it away in a game of chance that they don't really have control over. And at first, I thought that it made sense, because where Crosshair was sitting with Batcher, he could see the opponent's cards and could just be like, yep, that's a ace of clubs. You know, you're doomed. Get out. Okay, now this time go big. Yeah, whatever. But then they sent him away.
Don't be hasty.
They sent him away with Batcher, and she still just wins all the games. It's like, how is she doing that? Like, is she cheating somehow? If so,
she's got an IQ of 6,000.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean you can have an IQ of 6. That you can't have an IQ of 6,000. But even if you,
she's a clone.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that if you were playing straight up poker, head to head poker, the cards are going to have a huge influence on who actually wins. You can't rely on, oh yes, I'm just a better player. You know, and this is the sort of thing that James Bond does all the time, and I don't like it when he does it either.
I might point out, first of all, she has the Force, the light side is giving her the victory. But I might point out, James Bond does it in a game that is even more randomness of the game of Baccarat, which if you've ever tried to read the rules for Baccarat, there's kind of like no player agency. You're just waiting to see what cards show up from the boot. Anyway.
Yeah. And then they make fun of that in Star Trek Deep Space Nine in the episode Our Man Bashir, where Julian Bashir is basically playing James Bond and does the exact same thing. But at least they're making fun of the fact that this happens all the time. So I'm just not a fan of that trope. So I wasn't.
But to be fair, though, we don't know how that game is set up, because obviously that'll be a later question. She could be counting cards at that point.
She could be then, counting cards.
If she's counting cards, then she's ahead of them.
Like blackjack, if you can count your cards properly, you can give yourself an edge. But still no guarantee. So when you start with that stack of credits and then you build it up to some exorbitant amount, it's like, first off, your opponent's going to quit at some point and they realize something's fishy here. You're winning all the hands.
You would think.
You would think. You know, the Trandoshan, at least, I can be like, yeah, he's kind of dumb. But when Captain Mon comes in, I mean, he's a Trandoshan. I like Wookiees. They're mortal enemies. I can make fun of Trandoshans.
You're an alienist.
No, just Trandoshans.
Right. Yeah,
Trandoshanist. Yeah.
He's an anti-reptilianist. Anywho. All right, cool. Yes, good answer, though, Nathan. I agree that is a bit of a trope of, especially in Star Wars, because now that leads to my whole quintessential Star Wars story, because, you know, Han's winning the Millennium Falcon in Sabacc.
Lando.
But they finally explained that one as, Lando was trying to cheat and Han stopped him from being able to cheat. And that's what allowed Han to.
For this?
Yeah. Oh, you don't have this card. So you don't get the automatic win over there. Yeah.
Right.
So at least in Solo, it made, they made it make such sense.
An underrated movie.
Oh, definitely. But, even before Solo, it was never really implied that Han, cheated.
Planned out cheating?
It wasn't implied that Han is such a good player of Sabacc that he just went in knowing that he was going to win.
It was always implied that he got really lucky against Lando.
Right.
Like he lucked into the royal flush or whatever, and Lando was all like, what?
The idiot's array. Sir?
You know, and of course...
3,720 to 1.
Yes. Yeah. And of course he says, never tell me the odds, because idiot's array. There you go. Anywho, all right, moving on. Question numero quattro. Was that a Rathtar that ate Captain Mon at the end of this episode during the battle at the cargo dock? I'm going to go first here and say that yes. Yes, it was a Rathtar, and my meager amount of evidence, admittedly very meager, is one, the tongue and the way that it grabs you and pulls you in is very similar to the way that Finn got grabbed and pulled toward the mouth of the Rathtar in The Force Awakens. And two, this is no definitive source, I fully admit that, in Wikipedia it says Captain Mon was eaten by a Rathtar. Now, anybody can edit Wikipedia. It's like the Star Wars fan version of Wikipedia. But I think we're supposed to think that thing was a Rathtar with the way the tongue worked and the sound that it was making, which was very reminiscent of the sound made by the Rathtars in The Force Awakens. Could I be wrong? Of course, it could be some other random Star Wars monster. I believe
random alien, go!
There may be an episode coming up soon where Wrecker says, "Why is there always a big monster?" So, anyway, Derek, Rathtar? No.
Well, I was going to ask, did we skip question 3 on purpose?
Oh, whoops. I did pick question three, although not on
purpose. But it's fine because it just connects to the thing. It's the same thing.
Yes, absolutely my... Yes, there we go. My connection to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy, Rathtars.
I mean, I feel like the two connections are Rathtars and the game universe. Being not Sabacc. So.
Yes. No. Well, and then the Empire, right? And you were mentioning Andor and all that stuff, right? So there we go. So
we got that question covered already.
I talked about it. Yeah, when we were initially prepping for this, that I thought, hey, maybe it's a baby Sarlacc, right? Because then you mentioned like at some point that a Sarlacc can fit in a tiny jar.
It's in a jar on a desk.
You know, so at some point, you know, and again, how do Sarlaccs? I don't even know how they repopulate, right? Are they? We don't know. We haven't gone to the.
This is not that kind of a podcast. We haven't discussed Sarlacc propagation.
I always thought they ejected spores out into the air that would land somewhere in the desert and then burrow into.
I mean, maybe, right? Because at some point, if they're small, right? Because they can't be too close to the Sarlacc, the other one, because then they would just starve each other out. So it's got to, like you said, be mobile at some point to go somewhere else and then find a, you know, create dragon hole someplace, right? And
perhaps
nest there.
They are the Star Wars version of orcs from Warhammer 40K, and they do eject spores, but they eject them all the way into space. And that's how they get to other planets. And it's panspermia from the Sarlacc.
That's a pretty good range for spitting that far.
That's right.
I mean, have you seen a Sarlacc and how big they are? Yeah.
You could eat a spaceship, you know?
Yeah, but to be able to still shoot it out of, you know,
it's like
the ozone into space would still
Starship
be pretty powerful.
Troopers, the artillery bugs in Starship Troopers that launch the weapons at the spaceships from their butts. So,
anyways.
Nathan, or it's like the Pergil, and they just, you know, shoot them directly into hyperspace.
There you go. Maybe.
All right. Yeah, so my answer is absolutely not. There's no way that's a Rathtar. That tentacle didn't look anything like a Rathtar to me, and I think Scott's the one who went into Wikipedia and edited it, and that Captain Man was...
What? How dare... Actually, I didn't, but I should have.
I confirmed this.
I'll be honest, I had not checked Wikipedia, otherwise my answer would be yes, because I think if it's on there that it probably is meant to be a Rathtar, even though I don't think that tentacle looked very much like one. You know, we've only seen a small handful of Rathtars. So, you know, who's to say that there's not purple ones?
I just found out during my research here on Wikipedia about Rathtars is that there's a comic, or a story rather, of Darth Maul and the Rathtars, where Darth Maul has to fight Rathtars. I'm like, well, this is cool.
That sounds awesome.
Dual double lightsaber.
Yeah, but there's a great image of him like jumping toward its mouth, chopping off tongues with his Sith saber, and more tentacles are coming for him, and the fangs are all dripping with the green goo. And
what's really funny about
some big monster.
What's really funny about Rathtars to me is that they were invented to look like boulders, so that they could have Indiana Jones running away from a boulder in The Force Awakens.
Yep. Thank you, J.J. Abrams, for your in joke. Aficionado status. All right. So we kind of got three and four questions at the same time. There you go. Yep. Economic podcasting. Question five. Will Disney make a home version of the Balance card game? And if they do, would you play it? And guys, I sent you a link in the Facebook chat to the data bank entry for episode four, A Different Approach, that includes some concept art of the cards for the Balance game. So if you go to that data link that I sent you and scroll down a little ways, there's a six image, A Different Approach episode stills, nine images, A Different Approach concept art gallery down at the bottom right underneath Crosshair's picture where they have the official synopsis of the episode. And if you click on that and scroll through, you'll see that there are two slides in that slideshow that talk about what the cards for this game look like. And there's even a note that says each deck contains 30 cards. Please see page 9 for deck details. Of course, this is a behind-the-scenes artist manual, so we don't have access to page 9 for deck details. But there are two decks. There's a black-backed deck and a red-blacked deck. And each player has one deck, and each deck contains 30 cards. And there are suits and trump cards and so on. And in the second slide about balance, they show the three spell cards that Omega got in order to beat Captain Mon, because the droid bartender said, ah, the three spells. That means this game is over. And they have, of course, Arabesh writing on the three spells, and they talk about what their translations are and how each deck has one copy of each of the three spells. The three spells are buff, deflect, and then there's another deflect. And I can't help but feel how much they look like stuff related to the father, the son, and the daughter from Mortis, of course. There's a double-sided tree as one of the deflects, a eclipse as one of the deflects, and then like a glowing stone or circle as the buff card. So, yeah. And the artist notes include, please vary brushstrokes and worn texture between each card, making them, meaning that somebody at Lucasfilm Animation spent a lot of time on instructions for how to make these cards look and kind of hinted around that there may be rules for this game on page 9 of whatever artist manual that is backstage. So obviously my answer is yes, Disney's making this and they've already made the rules and whatnot. What do you think, Derek? Am I overreading it?
Well, I mean, they did say that they literally like made an actual game for this episode. Like there was, you know, out there to your point. Like I said, obviously somebody literally was tasked to create another card game, right, outside of Sabacc, for Star Wars. So somebody did this. I'm not a fan of it. To answer your question, would I buy it? I'm not a fan of it. That I would one buy it because honestly. It looks too much like Sabacc, and I still don't have ever bought one of the Sabacc Hasbro games that they've published. And because like if you're going to put that much effort into it, like I would have preferred them to actually make like a card game, like give me like, oh, I take my Sarlacc versus your Rancor. Like that's what we're waiting for. Right. So like you would think that somebody would have put that like in verse, right? Like at this point, where's their Pokemon or where's their magic or where's their Star Wars CCG? Yes. but it's Earth CCG or something.
Yes. It's World of Warcraft. Anyway, sorry.
So, but I mean, it's cool. Like I appreciate that when they do that kind of stuff, because that reminisces to what they used to do at like all the time with Lucasfilm stuff. Like, you know, when we've had Eric Walker, you know, friend for the Ewok movies on, like he talked about, like people would like literally just, you know, put all this information and lore to all these characters that were just these little sidebar characters or these outfits of why they were wearing this or looked like this and all that stuff. And I appreciate that. Right. So I appreciate that they were trying to do something different with another quote unquote card game, because you would think that they would have more than just Sabacc out there. Right. It's a far galaxy. Not everybody initially had Sabacc as one universal game, even though, like we said, we jokingly almost everyone speaks English. Right. Yeah. But I know it's a universal translator and that's what we hear. I just find it funny because I was trying to remember, because, again, I've only seen The Last Jedi really once. So when they're doing the whole casino scene, like they're, and then even when they had it in Boba Fett, when we were at, what was the casino with Flashdance, Twi'lek, what was her name of her casino?
I know who you're talking about.
Max
Rebo was.
Yeah, it was Max Rebo.
Mysteriously wasn't there the day it exploded.
Come to work that day. I don't know what.
But anyways, like I know they have like roulette. I feel like I've seen that at somewhere. Like they had like a roulette, like the ball going around somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I remember seeing in The Last Jedi they had like some type of slot machine. I feel like I can't remember.
Because the little diminutive guy mistook BB-8 for a slot machine.
I
kept.
Okay, so I was okay. Yeah. I'm remembering. My memory's not that hazy.
We didn't see any slot machines, but they have to have had them for him to think that BB-8 was one.
Yes. So fair enough. So that's maybe what I was remembering. But anyways, I'm assuming that there's other types other than their sports betting and fight betting that they, you know, they put money on as well too. And guess cockfighting, if you want to say that in quotes, right? Because they have the monsters and all that stuff fight each other. Rancor fighting, yes, in a sense.
There you go.
But yeah, so
over Rancors.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm kind of like, okay, cool. Finally, you know, 45 years later or whatever.
And to your point about there has to be other games besides Sabacc, in Star Wars The Old Republic, we get Pazak, which is kind of sort of a different card game. Much like Sabacc, though, or unlike Sabacc, I should say, they don't play it that much with physical cards. Pazak was very much holograms on the table kind of cards, which there's, of course, a version of Sabacc that you can do.
But then that'd be Djarik, right? The hollow table?
Well, then the Djarik was like the hologram
chess.
Chess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this like gives you a hologram of cards. It's like playing a card game on your phone.
Or I was going to say, or electronic blackjack or poker, yeah, whatever, yes, it is.
Yeah, or video poker.
Yeah, video poker. Yeah.
Like, these represent cards, right, well, even though they're not cards.
Yeah. Nathan, are you going to buy this game if it comes out? What do you think?
Well, I almost feel like...
Are they going to make one?
I almost feel like they have to at this point. I mean, you don't put this much effort into creating a card game if you're not going to do something with it. So we're either going to see it again in further Star Wars, or we're going to see it in real life, or both. And the answer is no, I'm not going to buy it. For the same reasons that I don't buy the Sabacc card games. I don't care that much about playing a in-universe game. I'd rather play a game that is... about that universe.
And then playing Sabacc in the game.
Yes. Like you see on Star Wars. I draw two Destiny. Look, it's a 5 and a 6. I win. I hit both your cards.
I want a clone trooper deck that involves trooper Sabacc where all the clones can be used as clone cards.
Yep. And unfortunately, in the modern Star Wars CCG that was originally made by Decipher, there's a card that basically shuts down Sabacc.
It's so, a defensive shield, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a defensive shield, yeah. Which is a shame, because that was such a great addition to the game, but what are you going to do? All right, okay, well, whatever we're going to do it after we take this break, where Kevin is going to tell us about the rest of the shows you can hear on the FPN.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
Right, and we are back to discuss episode 5 of Star Wars The Bad Batch Season 3, Stuffy Doll. And I get to say that wholeheartedly for episode 5 because we open with a scene of Omega finally reunited with everybody and hugging her OG Stuffy Doll And actually, if you guys are interested in the Stuffy dolls, there is literally a home crafting arts and crafts project step-by-step guide to make your own version of the Tuca doll that Omega has had all season long, out of straw and thread and glue and styrofoam balls. And just go to StarWars.com and you can check out that section of the Bad Batch in the data bank area, which, you know, to me, I'm like, why am I... But I think this is actually a cool idea that they give parents the option to do that with their kids because, well, how cool is it to do Star Wars arts and crafts? Anyway, but this episode is officially titled The Return, and we'll jump right into it with the five questions. What did you like best about this episode? And I'm actually going to go first again because I liked the classic Dave Filoni double meaning of this title because it was the return, obviously, of the group to Pabo, and also the return of Crosshair joining the group. And finally, Crosshair returned to the weird outpost on Bataku.
Hoth 2.0. 4.
Yes, yes.
Yes, Hoth 2.0. Barton 4, where he originally came to his senses after the Empire treated him like a totally dispensable and disposable piece of equipment and turned its back on his fellow clone troopers, and he shot that Imperial officer and murdered him, and that's what got him thrown in jail at Mount Tantus in the first place. I just love how it's various returns. You know, the return of them to Pabo, the return of Crosshair to the group, the return of Omega to the group, because she's finally been brought back from Mount Tantus, and then, of course, the return to Hoth 2.0. And the return of the Ice Vulture bird that Crosshair kept seeing last season when he was trudging through the ice. It was really cool. Derek, what did you like best about this episode?
I agree with the returning back to Hoth 2.0. I did appreciate that. But I, again, going back to character development, again, with Crosshairs, I really like this episode. We actually get the interaction between him and Hunter at some point, right? That conversation where Omega's like, just talk to him. But little does she know it's easier said than done, right? But they're finally put into a spot where, obviously Crosshairs, quote unquote, help save Hunter, right? And all that stuff. But at the end of the day, the conversation got cut just a little short. I probably would have liked a little bit more longer conversation with them. Just because, again, I get it. I want to see that character depth and what, Crosshair saying, like, hey, I know I quote unquote betrayed you, but I'm the good soldier, right? I'm the one that I thought I was doing what was right. And then when the Empire betrayed me, then I realized, okay, they weren't that. And now I'm back on your side. But at the same time, Hunter's like, yeah, but we're, kind of the perception of, yeah, we were brothers, though. You should have been above that, right? So it definitely has a great story of where two people come at different ends, right? And the way they think that they're doing something, like we've always talked about, right? There's plenty of bad guys thinking that they're doing the right thing. So are they really bad guys, right? Again, this is where it becomes that moral dilemma for people sometimes. And again, I like that. I like that they kind of brought into some of that stuff. And again, there's the whole point of Crosshair's struggling, all right? He's missing shots, his hand shaking, all that stuff. So I really like to see that with that character growth. And like I said, I thought they continue to do. Again, it's a slow burn. We're on episode 5. We got 13 more episodes, right? I think they're doing 18, we said, or 16 or whatever. So it's going to be maybe a slow burn. And maybe by the end, we'll finally get the resolution we're looking for. But no, like I said, I really like that about these past couple episodes with more about Crosshairs, because we did miss that, right? I mean, we didn't get a whole lot of that last season. It was more kind of him with the Empire, like we talked about. We really liked those episodes, I think, when we got to see the Empire side of things, when we got those couple of episodes, obviously, when we had that episode with Crosshairs here and the way things went down. So again, just that coming back, making it full circle, and essentially, Hunter kind of re-accepting Crosshairs back into the Bad Batch.
Yes, he returns, and he was coming to grips with that idea that serving in the army of the Republic was very different than serving in the army of the Empire. Because, you know, we talk a lot about how Star Wars is anti-war, and it very much is. But there's a big difference between the Imperial troops and honorable warriors from other societies. And so being in the Clone Army, serving the Republic, at least until, you know, execute Order 66, was a whole different, more honorable thing. And Crosshair thought, well, I'm going to keep serving the army and keep doing that, and that's what the Empire is going to be like. But then he found out the hard way that's not at all what the Empire was like. So, Nathan, what did you like best about this episode?
So I love it when we have, not necessarily an episode, but in this case it was an episode, but when in storytelling we have a scenario where we, the audience, know things that the characters don't know. And that's what we have in this case, because we had the episode with Crosshair on this planet before. We know what this planet means to him. We know what happened here, and the rest of the Bad Batch doesn't. So there's a lot of storytelling that can go on without the rest of the Bad Batch knowing what's going on, but we, the audience, do. And I love that form of storytelling. And I also think they handled it well. Oftentimes, it's not handled well when one character knows something and another character doesn't know something. And you're like, why don't you just talk to each other? Well, in this case, they were actually trying to talk to each other. And a lot of it was just too painful for Crosshairs to bring up and actually talk about. And that felt natural. That felt like, okay, this is actually something that he would have difficulty talking about. This is not something that they could just sit down, have a conversation, and resolve everything. So I think it's good that they found a way to come to some sort of resolution. I don't think it's a full resolution. I think Crosshair and Hunter are still going to butt heads, but they're in a better place than they were before without everything having to be just spelled out in exposition, because we know things that Hunter doesn't.
Right, right. Yeah, their dramatic tension with each other was an excellent setup for the classic, oh no, they don't have all the information that they need to survive this encounter. All right, great. Okay, so Derek, what did you dislike the most about episode 5, The Return?
Going back to, they feel like characters are not remembering what they're supposed to be about, right? So there's two small quibs I have about this one. The first one is, have we not learned, Bad Batch, you have to leave somebody on the ship? Like, how many times are we going to do this?
Now, in fairness, they never learned that lesson. Well, so this isn't a lesson that they learned and then went back on. They just never picked it. Yeah, they should have.
And then the second one is, I'm sorry, but how does Hunter not feel, because he's the guy that's supposed to be this tracker hunter guy and feels these vibration things, does not feel vibrations of the giant slug worm burrowing through the ice? How does he not know that? I'm sorry, that to me was just poor writing on that part. Like, he should have felt those vibrations a mile. He was censoring thunderstorms that before they were even censoring thunderstorms on that one episode that we had in that season 2. And we get this and other things and all that stuff. So to me, it's like, okay, like, literally, I'm sorry, but tremors, okay, cool, but he should feel that. Like, he should have been able to pick that up. Like, oh, why is the ground shaking and vibrating? Like, that's my superpower.
I was just amazed that they can't have planned this, but maybe they did somehow. This episode came out really close to the theatrical release of Dune Part 2.
Yes.
And I could think was, Shai Halud is strong, you know, and so he's, you know, the worm is coming. And then, like, the worm started coming, and they had the little things that, like, you were talking about the sensors, Derek, that were like the thumpers, you know, doom, doom, doom. And the vibrations, or in this case, the frequency, was keeping the worm away. But yeah, as soon as they started walking across the snow, I was all, no, vary your stride, you must walk out of rhythm or the worms are going to get you. And then boom, why does there always have to be some big creature?
Again, another big creature. It's like, okay, like, and what's the crazy thing about it, it's like, this had nothing to do, even though whatchamacallit, Crosshairs, totally, they all went off the grid in the, you know, previous season with it. Like, all of a sudden now there's this giant worm creature thing. Like, okay, whatever. But like I said, it's just...
So we'll talk about this. We'll talk about this in question five, but I have a thought about your question.
But anyways, it's just those two things. Like I said, we still haven't learned that we need to leave somebody on the ship, even if it's EG5, the trash can. Like, let him be on the ship, or recruit R5 or something. Right? He's got to be out there somewhere at this point. Reds and get somebody to be always ready to fly the ship.
Yeah. All right, Nathan, what did you dislike about episode 5, The Return?
All right, so I did basically put this as question number 5, so we will get more into this. So I'll be very brief. They turned off the sensors. The things that were warding out this ice creature. Because they just assumed...
Yeah, there were sensors.
Assumed, the only thing that this was supposed to keep out are raiders, who are humanoids, who can walk right past it. Like we can, we just thought that this was okay.
I don't think that's what Crosshair was trying to say. He was saying that they had been set up as an early warning network for when the raiders would come to attack, and then he was all like, "But they don't need them anymore because I killed all the raiders."
Yeah, the blatant assumption that we don't need these to be on anymore for no good reason. That was my biggest... So why are we turning these off? I understand that they had a reason, but I think that reason was dumb, and we'll get to that in question 5.
Okay. Well, then I will sum up here. My objection, or the thing I hated the most about this episode was, why did we take Echo's ship instead of the Marauder? The Marauder's a much cooler, more combat-effective ship that was designed for battle and commando raids, and instead we took Echo's, Uber Lyft ship that he has from somewhere.
His Republic cruiser.
But it's not. It's just kind of
a cruiser.
Like transport.
His taxi.
Yeah. Anyway, I was bummed to not see the Marauder out doing stuff. And also, for a couple of seconds, I thought, why do they still have that cargo ship they stole in episode 4 when Crosshair was telling her, don't keep the ship, the Empire can track it. And then I realized, oh, wait, no, this is a third ship. This is an entirely different ship. It's the one that Echo flew to come there to Pabo and meet with them. And
anyway. Apparently ships cost a lot of money, but anybody can pick one up.
That's right, exactly. All right, question number 3. I won't skip it this time. What connections did you draw to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy? This one was a cool one for me. Echo was back. It was cool to see Echo back. He is a bridge between Clone Wars and the Bad Batch. I mean, most of the characters are, but him specifically, because he was in Clone Wars in a pretty pivotal arc from way back, and we never thought we'd see him again. And, then he came back as the rescued dude with the robot hand and all that stuff, and... it was cool to see him return and sort of fill the void that was left by Tech. And he even made sure to take a moment to talk about how it would have been great to have Tech there with him because he needed Tech to reprogram the Imperial pad. Totally synchronized went to take a moment for Tech. So pour one out for the goggle guy. Anyway, Nathan, what connections did you draw to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy?
Just to piggyback on the Echo thing, this does speak to my point earlier. When I say earlier, I mean last season when they killed off Tech. Part of the reason that I feel they chose Tech to be the one to kill off is because Echo kind of fulfills the same role. And even though he said, oh, this would be so much easier with Tech here, Echo still did the thing. So he still fulfilled that role. So there's still a redundancy if Tech is there. So it still makes sense to me why, from a storytelling standpoint, why Tech is the one they chose to write out. Other than that,
yeah, he rode out into the sun.
he rode now. Straight down into a great chasm,
which he still might be alive. There's been many people who have fallen in a chasm and still survived.
That I suppose that's true, and Mace Windu might still be alive too, but until they make a return, I'm not expecting it or counting them as alive. But then again, we all thought Echo was dead back in the Citadel arc. He came back.
I mean, Bucky, they could reprogram him and make him the Winter Soldier.
That's a whole different Disney property. but still Disney. So,
but yeah. Yet also, sidekick got lost, came back, robot arm. Wait a minute.
I feel like I've seen this story somewhere before. Anyways, other than that, big connection, we went back to Hoth. 2.0. Hoth 2.0. Yeah. I do love ice planets, so I had no qualms about going back to an ice planet. But you know, that was a big, obvious connection there to last season, seeing Crosshair on that planet and come back to that planet. Beyond that, not too much, I think. Most of the connection was to that other episode.
All right, Derek.
But of course, there's always some monster. I think I'm changing my best part of the episode to being getting Scott to do the whole "there's always some monster" thing.
Why is it always some big creature? I gotta get the line. Is it creature or monster? Anyway, Derek, what was your connection to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy?
Nothing in the Star Wars other than the ones you guys mentioned that I could think of, right? You know, other than it did feel like Dune, and it also felt like Jurassic Park, right? Where he's got to go all the way to the end of the compound, and he's got to go pump. But this time, the Velociraptor didn't get Samuel L. Jackson, and Wrecker still has his hell body. But yes, I definitely was like, oh, okay, we got to, you know, pump that. And I appreciate them, you know, obviously, you know, Wrecker didn't have to worry about it. Like, oh, it's stuck, right? I have to wait till the last minute before it loosens up. Obviously, he's super powerful. I'm surprised he just didn't rip off the handle, right? But overall, though, I did enjoy that quite a bit. So, but yeah, like I said, you could put a lot. I mean, it kind of goes into my next question a little bit if it helps segue into it. You know, I did appreciate that they're still doing kind of the typical clone when there's other clones and doing remembrance, right? They do stuff with the helmets, right? We've seen that all through the Clone Wars. We saw that obviously in the final episode of season 7, right? When Ahsoka does that and Rex do that as the, the Republic cruiser crashes there, and then they still end up, you know, burying the others, even though they were against them. And then they put all their helmets on the stakes. So the helmets definitely represent, the kind of the remembrance of the clone troopers.
And it's in some cases, it's a very dark and violent expression of things happening in the Star Wars galaxy when you see helmets on poles, like in The Mandalorian, where their helmets of those stormtroopers are lined up outside the planet, the desert city there on Nevarro. But then other times, it's like in The Clone Wars Season 7 at the end, it's a sign of respect. But you know who really focuses on keeping the helmets and almost revering them? Is of course the Mandalorian warriors from back in the day, right? And the armorer and all that stuff, the weapons and the armor are like a religious rite to them. And I wonder if the clones do this as some sort of subconscious DNA memory from Jango Fett, because, you know, he was all about Mandalorian culture and stuff, right? And of course, I think maybe Boba Fett does it because of his dad, his clone father as well. I just thought about that recently.
Nathan's talked about a lot is, and what's made the clone troopers cool is that they make their helmets unique, right? They all do different decals and stuff. And that's no different than what soldiers of today or back past days did with their dog tags. And when they died, that's what you would do. You would take one dog tag, put it on the grave, and the other dog tag you would take back with you to give to a family member. Obviously, there's only one helmet, but that's the same thing, that they were honoring them by putting their unique piece that they embroidered as part of their military clothing and put it on, right? So,
and Sabine personalizes her armor, and Bo-Katan personalized her armor, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, in the real world, Star Wars is George Lucas's response to Vietnam. And in the Vietnam War, personalizing your helmet as a grunt out in the jungle was a big, almost, you know, personalization was almost a religious
ritual
for those guys in Vietnam. A ritual, yes, thank you. Anyway, but yes, so there you go. Yeah, good catch on the helmets and all. And this is a good segue, like you said, into question four here. Who did question four?
I did. Yeah, so go for it, Derek. So obviously they have the Empire abandoned this, right? Because that was part of the whole episode that they had there, right? That they were leaving the base, right? They were taking all the armor, right? That the Emperor had called for, right? Or whatever, he put his Amazon order in, and he was buying everything. So they had to ship it all out. And obviously, ironically, they basically abandoned it, but there was still enough power to keep the sensors on, right? Which was like, I mean, yeah, they're still relatively, quote unquote, still within a certain, you know, not very long time frame, even though we know the time that Crosshairs and Omega spent had been like, I think you said, Nathan, was like 60 some days or something when you talked about it the previous.
I think it was about 6 months.
Or 6 months. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. 6 months. Sorry. 360 days. Or no, that would have been 12 months.
About 180.
180. There you go. So anyways, so we know it's been a period of time. So, but the fact that they still left the lights on, essentially, like you said, to ward this off this monster, it's like, I found that a little weird just because you figured out, hey, why does the Empire? But at the end of the day, I was like, well, they might want to come back at some point, right? And this is where they could repopulate the base if they needed to. But anyway, so my question was, as Crosshairs was doing that, right? Like, it was weird that they had like all these clone trooper helmets just left there, right? Because there was only a couple of clones that died in the episode. But there was all these helmets everywhere. So my thing was, and we saw this earlier in the season when the Emperor comes to Mount Tantus and we were choking about what's in those pods, right? That they're clones. So I was saying, well, do we think in those cases that Crosshairs was putting the helmets on top of, do we think those are cases are full of the dead clone troopers? Were they their coffins? Or was it just leftover plastoid armor that, again, the Bad Batch didn't bother to take with them, right? That would have been very beneficial for the war that Rex and Echo, I'm sure, could have used for armoring up. But anyways, what do you guys think were in those cases? Do you think they were clone trooper bodies, or that were the helmets that belonged to, or do you think it was something else?
Nathan, what do you think?
I'm going with something else because I think the people who decided what to take and what to leave were the Imperials. Not the clone troopers, but the officers above them, even after the one officer got killed. And I think they don't care about the clones. So they just let them be dead wherever they were. And they've been eaten by the ice vultures. Or
eaten by Shai Hulud.
Yeah. And they don't care enough to go get the corpses to do any sort of burial, much less a proper one. And the only reason that there are clone helmets there is because the clones who were there at the time respected each other enough to go get those helmets, but the Imperial officers did not. So they just left whatever they felt was not valuable enough to bother taking with them. And they probably left the sensors on just because we need them to be on when we leave so that the worm doesn't come get us. When we were flying out, they probably don't care about anything that's down there once they're out.
I'm surprised they didn't bomb it like they did in the first episode, right? Where Hemlock had them bomb, you know, that overgrown.
Yeah, and destroyed
Kamino.
I think the difference is those were scenarios where there's something valuable there that could fall into enemy hands. And this is a scenario where they just feel like it would cost us more in bombs to bomb the place than we would prevent people from getting if they ransacked it.
Yeah. I'm going to disagree with Nathan here. I mean, I agree the overall outcome, but in a much more dark side way, I think that this is supposed to be a mirror of real world military largesse because they left the power on. I think those boxes are not filled with corpses, but they're filled with useful supplies, but not useful enough to spend the resources to retrieve them. They left the power on, they left the junk behind because when the call came in to disengage and get out of there, they just dropped everything and left. And in the real world, the United States military did the exact same thing about 2 years ago when we pulled out of Afghanistan after the longest war in American history. And we left behind millions of dollars of worth of equipment, vehicles, weapons, and the Taliban has all that stuff now. And so I think that this is a sort of a sly political commentary, and I'm probably reading way too much into it, and it could just be not specifically about Afghanistan and the United States military, but more a military force like the Empire that is just awash with waste, and they don't care enough about the space to clean up the power protocols, turn off the lights, and take all the useful stuff with you, because they're not the rebellion. They don't need to, you know, conserve resources and save weapons and count every bullet and recharge their lasgun battery packs by putting them in a fire because they don't have actual power generators. All that stuff, you know? It's not Andor and crew. They got tons of suits of armor. They're just going to leave it behind because who wants to bother to take it with you? And who wants to bother to turn off the lights? And that's exactly what the condition of the base was when our guys showed up in this episode and found it. And Hunter was like, what the heck's going on here? You didn't tell us this base was abandoned. And I love Crosshair's response to that. I didn't get intelligence briefings in my cell. You know, I'm like, come on. It's just so acrimonious and acidic response. And yet also true. He was not getting intelligence briefings in his cell.
Well, why not?
Why would I know that? You know? So yeah, great question there, Derek. All right. Final question for this episode of the podcast and final question for episode 5. Take it away, Nathan.
All right. Why can't Basher just put up with that signal for a little bit instead of turning it off without any idea of what it's actually protecting against? I mean, all they had to do to avoid the Dune worm coming and eating them was not mess with the perimeter signal.
Yeah, so why? The answer here is, have you ever been around a little girl when her pet is unhappy?
Throw them back in the ship.
Oh, no, we can't leave anyone on the ship. That's an unwritten rule of Bad Batch missions.
That's it. That's the problem. Yes.
Everybody comes with us, right? You know, we don't care.
My answer is, why can't we just leave them on and let Batcher deal with it is because Omega cannot stand to see Batcher suffering from the high-pitched whine and yada yada.
Why do we even bring Batcher? Leave the dog at home.
And your little dog, too. All right, Derek, what's
actually, you find out that he's been more efficient than Omega has been recently.
I mean, that's true. He did notice the thing was coming before even Hunter, to your earlier point, Derek. Batcher noticed that the giant worm was coming before the guy who was genetically engineered to notice things coming.
And Batcher has saved, in episode 3, saved Crosshairs like twice. More than Omega did. So
Yeah.
So I'm fine with having and to be fair, I don't know, but obviously he's like trained, right? I mean, he was, you know, good. So he's like a good hunting dog. Like he's at least was trained in the way they were using him on Mount Tantus, and for what it was, he actually at least fits the story of why he's on there. So at least to credit, it's not just a pet that all of a sudden miraculously became. Like, again, you could put more into it, just like Scott was saying the last thing, but at least it feels like, oh, he was actually trained for sniffing out stuff and looking for stuff, right? Like he was trained to be a hunting dog.
Yeah. So he is at least useful. Nathan, what's your own answer? Why can't we just let Batcher deal with it?
Because they weren't willing to tell the little girl the dog can put up with it for a little bit.
Ding, ding, ding. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Yes, that's it.
Because Hunter's getting soft.
They were more concerned about the dog being comfortable than any sort of tactical sense.
Any sort of operational security. Tighten up your OPSEC, Clone Force 99.
I said they're getting soft.
And to answer Wrecker's question, this is why there's always a huge monster.
Yes.
And I looked it up. Monster. It is, why is there always a huge monster?
There we go. Good times. And I love that was in the exact previous episode. I thought to myself, oh, cool. It's a big Star Wars monster. It's going to eat somebody. Boom. He ate somebody. All right. Okay. Cool. Well, speaking of Star Wars cliches, it's time for Derek's favorite part of the show, and that is, what Star Wars t-shirts are we wearing this week? Derek, what do you got on?
So just to make sure that I don't get to forget to tell everybody, like, you know, I love this part of it, but I have a lot of Star Wars shirts. Even though I did go to the Lexington Comic and Toy Con this Friday, right? But I didn't buy any Star Wars shirts, though. Just the, you know, I decided I needed to have a little bit more in my repertoire of arsenal of clothing. Oh, so okay. Right. I'll have some other shirts to show you guys down the line. That'll be more fun. So I will talk about a couple things that I picked up in the card world that I got this past weekend. I did a trade with a friend I've done a couple of times. Not that he listens to the podcast, but you know, he's more of a Star Trek he's been doing for the CCG, and I still have like leftover stuff. So I've been doing it. So I got a couple of Endor foils, and I know Nathan will appreciate that.
Yes, Chewbacca of Kashyyyk. Oh, that was one of my favorite cards back in the day.
Yes, and this is an uncommon foil based off the rarity. And then the other one I got was the Tempest One foil, which is one of the rare foils, one of the four rare foils from the set. So
commanded by Commander
Iger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know if any correlation to Iger, Bob Iger at the time.
Commanded by Bob Iger.
Oh, even though it was done in 1983 before Iger even.
Did not own Star Wars at the time, so no.
So, but anyways.
Those are great. So as the listeners know, I am moving in, still in the process of unpacking, but moved into the domicile, woohoo! And I've been unpacking some of my boxes of old t-shirts, so I found my, appropriately enough, Solo, a Star Wars Story shirt, where you see Han Solo and Chewbacca and all those guys standing in front of the setting sun in very Western pose with their silhouettes that are slightly accented. And, you know, we talked a lot about Solo and Sabacc on this episode, so I thought it would be highly appropriate, and I haven't worn it in a while because it's been packed up in a box in my in-law's basement, so I'm glad to get this shirt back out and put it back in rotation.
Make Solo 2 happen.
Make Solo 2 happen.
Number one.
All right, but, Ethan, what do you got on there?
I am rocking it 8-bit style with Grogu. Ah! This is the way. The old Nintendo format. Yeah, I love that's those old awesome. Nintendo games. This is the format that was always on the cartridge. So I love that.
Yeah, good times. Well, if you guys out there want to get your own cool What a Piece of Junk t-shirt or mouse pad or iPad case or coffee mug, please head over to tpublic.com and check out the Fandom Podcast Network store so you can buy all of our cool merch and merch from the other cool podcasts here on the FPN. And speaking of the FPN, Nathan, let the folks know where they can find us out there on the internet.
You can find us pretty much anywhere pods are cast, including Podbean, where we have our master feed, fpnet.podbean.com. Also on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and of course, YouTube. You can find us on Facebook, What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast. You can email us, whatapieceofjunkpod@gmail.com. On X/Twitter, slash whatever remains of that, we're at What Wars. And on Instagram, you can follow the entire Fandom Podcast Network at Fandom Podcast Network. We're not super creative with the names, but I promise the podcasts are all better than that. You can also leave us an Apple Podcast review. And Derek, why do we want those Apple Podcast reviews and any other type of reviews?
Well, if you don't want us to have to deal with a large monster every week, then we need to keep the sensors on. And that's how we do it, with 5-star reviews. So we appreciate any type of feedback, but the more 5-star reviews, the better, because that means, you know, folks can search for us a lot easier. Things get recommended to them. You know, obviously any of the Fandom Podcast Network podcasts are great, but obviously What a Piece of Junk is, you know, at the front of the Star Wars when you type that in, right? Or if they want to type in Bad Batch or whatever, more 5-star reviews, that helps the following new listeners reach us and become new space junkies.
Absolutely.
So that's off behind me there. That's why they had to turn off the sensors. The Bad Batch wasn't getting enough 5-star reviews. That answers my question.
It's all solar powered. It's all solar powered, so you need 5 stars in order to generate enough solar energy. It's a lot of power.
Yeah,
it's
that is a lot of power. Sensor web. Well, they made a whole super weapon that does that.
Exactly.
They've made three super weapons.
Yeah, but only one of them runs on "We sucked up a star."
True.
That's right. All right. Thanks for joining us on this episode, you guys. We hope you had a good time. We had a great time making it for you. And so we want to just let you know that you should reach out to us with any feedback you have about how we can make the show better and more enjoyable for you. And please remember to always respect each other and always respect each other's fandom. All right, Nathan, punch it.